dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman of extraordinary intelligence who has brought it to bear in many capacities for quite a period of time is, I'm very pleased to say, really proud to say, our guest for this full hour. Her name is Dr. Carol Swain. She has become one of America's leading public intellectuals, a woman of extraordinary accomplishment in academic circles, notably with her PhD and her legal training. She is a woman who has taught at some of the best schools in the country, notably Princeton University and Vanderbilt University. She has served on the 1776 Commission and worked tirelessly to educate our countrymen and women about the true character of our country, its true history, and efforts that are being made to create and propagate false narratives that are very dangerous to the American experiment, to our Constitution, to our people, and to our country. She is the author of a brand new book, a co-author of a brand new book entitled Black Eye for America, How Critical Race Theory is Burning Down the House. Dr. Swain, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It is so good to have you with us, and congratulations on this really important new book.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to report that the book has become a bestseller. Within a week of being published, it became number one, often on Amazon in the area of democracy, inclusive education methods, and constitutional books. In fact, one time it beat out the Constitution, I believe.
Well, don't get carried away here. We want people to be reading the Constitution too. But this is really evidence, I think, of what we're going to be talking about in the course of this hour, which is, I think, the hunger of the American people for the truth about what is going on in this country in many respects. And you've been addressing lots of them, but specifically with respect to this idea that the country is racist, systemically racist, and that people of color like yourself and minorities more generally cannot get ahead without having white supremacists get in their way and trying to suppress them. So let me start, if I could, Carol, just quickly with your personal story, because it seems to me it is such a rebuttal to that whole narrative and the premises that underpin it. And it gives us some insights into the people who are propagating that false narrative as well. So tell us about your background quickly, if you would.
I will, but I want to say first that the white supremacists today are the progressives. And what they're pushing is a narrative and a reset that will ensure that racial and ethnic minorities will never catch up. They will always be behind if they internalize what's being taught them and what is being imposed by the new system of systemic racism that targets whites as well as racial and ethnic minorities. So
that's a fantastically interesting point to which we will return in the course of this conversation. But again, okay. Just a little bit of your background.
I will. All right. My background, I was one of 12 children born and raised in rural Virginia. The early part of my life, I lived in a two-room shack. The children slept on the kitchen floor. There were only two rooms, so it was an all-purpose house. And we had no indoor plumbing. And to go to school, we had to walk probably it was a half mile to get to the highway to to stand on the highway to catch a school bus, you know, during the winter. And as a consequence, we missed a lot of school, especially when it snowed or the weather was especially cold. And I dropped out of school after completing the eighth grade. I married at 16, had my first child by the time I was 17. And when I was 21, I had three small children. People stepped into my life who encouraged me. And I ended up getting a high school equivalency in my early 20s, going to a community college, and getting the first of five college and university degrees. I have a two-year degree in business, a four-year degree in criminal justice from a private liberal arts school where I graduated magna cum laude. I have a master's from a state university, Virginia Tech, PhD, University of North Carolina. Then I went back to college after I had become a tenured professor at Princeton. I went back and got a master's in law. And so that, I would say, Frank, that I was born into a system of systemic racism because I was born in 1954. And during that time, Black went to separate schools than whites and everything was segregated. That was the era of the separate water fountains. But I watched the civil rights movement unfold and the collapse of systemic racism, and it collapsed with our nation passing three major civil rights acts in the 1960s. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 that resulted in desegregation of facilities. It opened up employment opportunities. It banned discrimination on account of race, sex, national origin, and religion. The 1965 Voting Rights Act and the 1968 Open Housing Act. These three great pieces of legislation made us colorblind under the law. After that, the discrimination that existed was individual discrimination, and we watched that collapse. And during this time, in my state of Virginia, it was the Democrats that led the resistance against school integration. In fact, the Brown versus Board desegregation case happened the year I was born. I was I was in the sixth or seventh grade before we integrated our schools. And so it was resisted that long by the Democrats in Virginia. So Democrats know a lot about systemic racism because they're always behind segregation and the resegregation efforts.
And not just in Virginia, it needs to be noted. This was true throughout the South, I think, for many decades after the Civil War up into the middle of the last century. And Carol, I think this is what's so important is that you've lived the transformation of our country from one that at least part of it was systemically racist to one in which all of it has now moved past that. And I think to the great credit of both civil rights leaders and others in our country.
Well, Frank, I feel like Forrest Gump. I think I could tell my story just like Forrest Gump, because I remember what I was thinking as a child and how I was observing the world. And I can go through every decade with the lens of my eyes watching what was happening in the world.
Well, and I think in a way that's what is informing your important works, including the one we're going to talk about here in a minute. But before we get to that, I did want to just invite you to talk a little bit about the commission that you were appointed to by President Trump late, sadly, in his term, as an effort to try to really challenge this progressive, if you will, racist narrative. Notably being promulgated by the New York Times and various, you know, spinoffs from its 1619 project. Right. Tell us a little bit about the 1776 Commission and the work it did and how it is informed and really, I think, enabled much of what you have been working on for so long and are now especially focusing in on this critical race theory business?
Well, Frank, I don't know if you know that before the 1776 Commission, Bob Woodson had assembled a group of scholars, not just scholars, but they were activists, people from different walks of life, and we created 1776 Unites, and we held press conferences, and we came against the 1619 Project very strongly. And so that was going on several months before President Trump signed an executive order banning the use of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion in federal programs. And he also signed the order to establish the commission. It was December before the commission was actually formulated and announced. And by the time I agreed to serve, it was pretty clear that, you know, the election was already with Biden as the presumptive nominee. I accepted the position, even though many people told me not to, because they said as soon as Biden gets in, he's going to dissolve the commission. And as you know, he did. But I accepted it along with other people like Larry Arnn, the president of Hillsdale, Matthew Spaulding, who also works at Hillsdale, used to work at the Heritage Foundation, because we knew that it was important to come up with a plan to educate the American people, especially the young people, about our nation's Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence will be celebrating its 250th anniversary in 2025. And so we were commissioned to look into better ways of teaching people about our nation's heritage, in particular, the Declaration of Independence, and how it was a document that was enduring for the ages. It laid the foundation and the philosophy for us to eliminate slavery, to bring about equality for women, to have a Civil Rights Act, to get through, you know, the major wars of our times. And it remains an enduring document. And so that is what our commission was. And we worked very rapidly, as you know, and produced a report that was released on January 18th. And as soon as President Biden was inaugurated, that same day, he eliminated our commission.
Define, if you would, against the backdrop of what you just said, Carol, about the Declaration of Independence and the foundation that it created for true equality in our country, whether it's women's rights or whether it's the rights of minorities or others. How does that contrast with diversity, equity, and inclusion as concepts? One would think that they're actually synonymous with the tenets of the Declaration, and yet not so much in the hands of, well, you call them progressives. I think I call them the Marxists amongst us, the radical left.
Well, I mean, whatever we call them, I think conservatives know that we're talking about the same group. And when you look at the Declaration of Independence and our Constitution, those founding documents, today it's so popular to denigrate the forefathers, the men and women that drafted the Constitution, and say they were hypocrites. But what they did was draft documents that were much greater than themselves. And if you even, you know, you want to make comparisons with the biblical characters that were so flawed, those of us who are Christian believe that the Bible is the inspired word of God, despite the flaws of the writers. The document itself, you know, is enduring, it lives. And you find that in the Declaration of Independence that declared that all men are created equal and they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. You know, and so these inalienable rights apply to all human beings. And anyone who studied the founding period would know that the men and women who were involved in founding a nation, they were deeply conflicted over slavery. And one of the sources of misinformation or mischaracterizations of the Constitution itself is that when it was ratified, that blacks were considered 3/5 of a human being. And the 3/5 clause had nothing to do with the humanity of black people. It was about allocating seats in Congress, because at that time, each locality was awarded one representative per 30,000 citizens. And so in the South, they had over 600,000 slaves. Had they given one additional representative per 30,000 residents or citizens, the South would have had vastly more representatives in Congress than the North. And so it was the abolitionist, non-slaveholding North that pushed for the 3/5 clause.
That's a fascinating point. Yeah.
But the people that propagate the lie that blacks were 3/5 of a human being are well educated. They know exactly what they're doing. It's part of a false narrative that they use. And
to what agenda, to what end are they using that false narrative, whether it's about the Declaration or whether it's about the founders or whether it's about, you know, the country that has been blessed by those men and women and documents?
Well, they want to say that America is racist to its core, that it's in the DNA of the nation, and they go back to slavery. But when they tell their narrative of slavery and the first blacks that arrived on American shores in 1619, they leave out the part that the first blacks that came to America for the first 40 or 50 years, they were indentured servants, and they came along with white indentured servants. They served 7 years or so, and then they were set free, and they became the backbone of free blacks in America. And then even after slavery became permanent, if a slave converted to Christianity, they were also set free until greed ended that part of it. And we leave out conveniently that there were black slaveholders, Native American slaveholders, as well as white slaveholders. It was a trade that the American government allowed to continue. So the government itself is responsible, but we can't say that it was just white people. And the people that are pushing this narrative about America being such a racist country to its DNA, they conveniently leave out the fact that there were always white abolitionists that fought against slavery. White set up the Underground Railroad. White philanthropists set up black schools and universities. And there has been trillions of dollars poured into the black community trying to address the past and present effects of slavery and discrimination. And so when you look at the American story, the true American story, it is a story of people working together across racial and ethnic lines. And the civil rights movement was one of the high points of American history. The problem with the 1619 Project and the agenda of the progressive left is that they distort history. They cherry pick it in a way to demonize whites at this point in history. And they seem to be trying to turn the tables. And at the end of the day, it's not about equality. It's not about diversity or equity or inclusion. It's about weaponizing race and using it to bring down the American system.
Yeah, that's what I want to get into with you now. Again, our guest is Dr. Carol Swain, and we're talking about the book that she has just co-authored entitled Black Eye for America, How Critical Race Theory is Burning Down the House. Let's take just a minute before we get into the agenda and the perps who are promoting it. Just define what critical race theory is, if you would, Dr. Swain.
Well, with critical race theory, it's one of many different critical theories that come out of Marxism. And so at this moment in time, we focus on the critical race theory, but there's also critical queer theory, critical feminist theory, critical colonialism theory, and you can just keep going down the road, because there's many critical theories. And with
But the point is that all of them are products of Marxism, Marxist doctrine and agendas.
Right. And with critical race theory, it comes from academia, and a lot of bad ideas come from academia, but critical race theory is one of it. And it divides the world into the oppressed versus the oppressor. And with economic Marxism, you got the oppressed, who were the workers, and you got the oppressors, and they were the owners of the modes of production. What critical race theory is, it argues pretty much that that racism, again, is in the DNA of American society, that all white people are oppressors. They have a property interest in their whiteness, that they need to divest themselves of their whiteness, and that they have used their whiteness to set up a system that benefits themselves and subordinates racial and ethnic minorities. The theory also argues that all minorities are oppressed victims, that racism is permanent. There's nothing you can do about it, that only white people can be racist. And so when white people decide that they want, you know, to overcome, if they want to liberate themselves or overcome what their group has done, they're supposed to become consciously anti-racist. And they become consciously anti-racist by denouncing racism wherever they see it. First, they confess it in themselves, because they all have to confess that they are racist. It's in their DNA. They have undeserved privileges, even if they were the descendants of abolitionists and members of the Underground Railroad. All white people under this theory are racist. They're racist forever. They're the only group who have the ability to be racist, and that is ludicrous even on its face. And then all minorities are oppressed, and that only white people can release them. And if you think about it, that is a white supremacist theory. It's designed to keep and sow conflict between blacks and whites. And it's not something that I was exposed to as a child. I was exposed to, patriotism and just the belief that I lived in a great country, which I still believe that I have lived most of my life in a great country. I don't know what our nation is right now. I'm trying to figure it out like everyone is. But with critical race theory, it has ties to critical legal theory. It has ties to postmodernism and other philosophies, but it is a destructive force. And I would say that it is racist itself. It is a white supremacist theory that results in bullying and shaming white people because of the color of their skin. And as we point out in this book, Black Eye for America, which is set up in such a way that the first chapter introduces why this guy, young man, Chris Shore, and I came together to write the book. Chris has a PhD from Georgetown, but I hired him to be a research assistant. He was really good at his work, and so I brought him on as a co-author. And so that was my little bit of affirmative action.
And let me just go back to something that you said earlier, because I think it's, again, fundamental to understanding both what we're up against and what we have to do about it. You've made the point, and I think rightly so, that this is a product of a hostile ideology that is explicitly determined to destroy our country. I've had other guests, including Givan Fleet, who grew up during the Cultural Revolution in Communist China. And as you know, Carol, that was an era in which Mao used class warfare to divide the people of China and to secure his hold on power and to destroy his enemies. This is a sort of variation on that theme. I think everybody agrees. It's not so much class warfare in this country, it's race warfare. in this country. And I think your analysis of it, along with Dr. Shore's, is that we have, in fact, had this doctrine now deeply penetrated into our schools, into our government, into our military, into our culture, in a way, our society, and have lost sight of the fact that it is being perpetrated by Marxists and others who explicitly, I think, much as Mao did, seek the destruction of this country. Is that a reasonable characterization of the conclusions that you've drawn?
Yes, absolutely. And we also argue, and I've been saying this, you know, for a couple of years now, and this is not new to me. I saw the danger. I saw it just escalating after President Obama was selected. That's when you saw the Marxism rising on the college campuses, and it affects every sector of our society, including medicine and the sciences. And some of us would have never thought that you would see it in the heart sciences, or you would see the arguments being made. In fact, the teaching strategy that philosophy that math is racist, and that it is racist to require right and wrong answers from minority students. And that is will doom them to failure, because there's almost nothing you can do in our society that doesn't require basic math or some mathematical knowledge. And we know that for
let
many
alone
of us,
differentiating between right and wrong answers. I mean, this is madness, is it not?
It is. It is madness, because some of the arguments that they make is that getting to places on time, you know, setting quietly in a seat in a classroom, planning for the future, all of these things, pretty much being Christian, that this is whiteness. And hard work is whiteness. Almost everything that any of us do to be successful, they have characterized it as whiteness. And so, you know, the opposite of that is, I guess, criminal behavior and being unruly and not being on time and all of the opposites of the things that the rest of us did to be successful, that must be blackness, because everything that's positive, they have characterized it as negative and as whiteness.
And obviously, this is a formula for a lack of success on the part of Black people or anybody else who embrace these opposites of the things that make you successful. And again, this goes to the heart of the idea that you have a chapter in your book, Black Eye for America, in which you talk about critical race theory as being antithetical to American values. And these, I guess you might call them values or qualities that are esteemed. Why? Because they work. And they make not just the individual successful, but obviously they contribute to the success of the nation itself at the macro
thing,
level.
You asked about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the political left, what they have done is they constantly redefine words. And so, like, during my era, Black people like me and also everyone that fought in the civil rights movement, we wanted non-discrimination and equal opportunity. We wanted to be judged by the content of our characters rather than the color of our skin. Well, the political left does not want to be judged by the content of their character. Most of them, many of the leaders certainly don't have much character, but
or bad they character
want
with that.
Equal outcomes. They yeah. want it to be handed to you without any effort. And then this whole thing that standards have to be lowered for Blacks, that it's racist to expect Black children to learn standard English or to learn math or to learn how to behave. All of these things are destructive, but at the same time that they're taking away what young people need to be successful, they are also telling them that they deserve what other people have, the other people being those of us, regardless of race or ethnicity, who actually had a goal and a vision. We worked hard. We were able to achieve it. And during my day, all we wanted was non-discrimination and equal opportunity. And I would say that the civil rights movement was very successful and that racial and ethnic minorities were making tremendous progress until the Obama administration, the election of America's first, quote, Black president, turned the clock backwards, and we've been going backwards ever since.
Yeah. Carol, this is such an important point, and I wanted you to explore it with me. I think the irony of all of this, of course, is that many white American voters saw in the opportunity to elect the first, as you say, so-called Black president. He actually is half Black, half white, but identifies as Black, evidently, and has been, you know, regarded by, I think, all of us as a very important symbol of the actual changes that you've described in our country, that we were so far beyond racism, let alone systemic racism, that white voters by the millions turned out to elect Barack Obama. And yet, as you say, what came about, and I personally think it had a lot to do with his own Marxist leanings, his own commitment to the fundamental transformation of America, is that you saw a resurgence of this kind of incitement to racial divisions, this kind of, critical race activism. No?
Well, I mean, we certainly did. And the Marxist handbook and Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, the whole idea, the concept of community organizing, it was all about advancing an agenda that would divide Americans rather than unite us. And we see exactly what happens when they get power, because right now the whole nation is being divided, and it's not just around race. Look at the divisions over vaccinated people rather than unvaccinated people. They use the Marxist playbook in medicine, and there are doctors that are saying that they won't treat certain kinds of patients. If you're not vaccinated, you can't get life-saving treatments. And some of them are saying that if you're white and a Black person shows up in the emergency room at the same time, they're going to treat the Black person first, not necessarily saying they're going to treat the patient that has the most serious conditions. These people have taken it everywhere. And it's dangerous, it's un-American, it's unconstitutional, and we have to stand up and fight against it because it goes against human decency.
I want to come shortly to, you know, what we need to be doing about this, but just to dwell on this point for a moment, you know, I'm sure, of this question of lowering the standards. A professor, I believe, out in the University of California system of higher education was punished for refusing to acquiesce to the idea that Black students in his classes should be treated differently than white students, should be held to a lower standard than white students. And again, this goes to the heart of what you're talking about. I can only imagine what Martin Luther King would be thinking. He must be spinning at a very high RPM in his grave over how far we've departed from this idea of equal opportunity and the color blindness that he was urging on our country has now been so dramatically cast aside in favor of a kind of new racism. And whether it's white supremacism on the progressive side or whether it's inculcating in Blacks a certain racism towards whites or something else, I don't know. But it none of it is good for our country, is it?
To me, when I look at it, the Democrats, you know, they had this big debate about the big switch, you know, whether the Democrats and Republicans, you know, switch sides. The Democrats became the party of civil rights and the Republicans became the party of racism. That's their narrative. But if you actually look at what's happening with DEI and critical race theory, it's the same tactics that the Democratic Party has always used. They're resegregating Blacks. They're saying that they are inferior, that white people have to take care of them. And with this new twist is, you know, that they're actually now discriminating against whites. And so when we talk about systemic racism, I would say that the systemic any systemic racism that exists today is against white people, and it's against racial and ethnic minorities in the sense that it is pushing them down lower, lower, and lower. It's making it impossible for any Black child or any Hispanic child that would internalize what they're pushing to be successful. And so it's the Democratic Party doing what the Democratic Party has always done. To me, the strongest indictment against them is their own behavior right now.
I couldn't agree more. Again, our guest is Dr. Carol Swain, co-author with Dr. Chris Shore of Black Eye for America, How Critical Race Theory is Burning Down the House. Carol, one of your other chapters, which I just wanted you to develop a little further, because this really goes to the degree to which this is at odds with, you know, the not just the sort of founding principles and values of our country, but actually the Constitution and civil rights law. Talk about that. What is wrong with this picture that we're seeing treatment of different races differently in contrast to what you just described as the great success of the civil rights movement to get rid of that?
Well, to me right now, the most shocking behavior is the DOJ, the Department of Justice, under Merrick Garland. Because if anyone should know the Constitution of the United States and its civil rights laws, it would be the members of the Department of Justice. And yet, they are targeting parents and anyone who criticizes critical race theory or the Marxist agenda. And they're demonizing these people and just giving a blind eye to the real threats to American society. And the language of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which I would encourage people, you know, to Google it or look it up and just read it, it's very straightforward. It bans discrimination on the basis of race, sex, color, national origin, and religion. And with the banning of discrimination on the basis of race, of course, it was always focused on racial and ethnic minorities. But right now, at this moment in American history, white people are being targeted because of the color of their skin in the same way that Blacks and other minorities were once targeted. And to me, the most unconscionable part of it is the bullying and shaming of small children. In fact, they start the indoctrination as early as kindergarten, and they make children, because children don't naturally see racial and ethnic differences. They just see their friends. But they get them to focus on race, and they try to guilt out little white kids by telling them that they have white privilege and showing them, cherry picking parts of history, clips of films in which white people behave badly. And that's a part of our history. And I'm not opposed to civil rights history or discussing slavery or any part of America's past, but they cherry pick it in such a way that children that young could not possibly progress with their process, what they're being exposed to. And these ideologies that came from philosophy departments and departments at universities.
Political science. Yeah,
that it's K through 12 now, mm-hmm. A kindergarten. And we have Sesame Street and Nickelodeon and those children's programs all pushing a critical theory agenda. And while we're focused on critical race theory, they also push in critical queer theory and very much focused on trying to destroy all the traditional structures that make up American society.
And so the family. Including the family. Yeah, exactly. Talk a little bit about that,
churches.
Carol, because this is obviously part and parcel of what Marxists do, is to try to destroy, you know, sort of the nuclear family, as the Black Lives Matter organizers have described it. And otherwise, essentially have the state become the new parent for children, and
I mean that's what
following its dictates.
Yeah, that came from communists and the whole idea of public schools. But you had asked me about the civil rights laws. Well, there's the civil rights laws, 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1972 amendments that referred to colleges, And then there's the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment that protects our citizens. And, you know, whites, all persons are protected by the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. And we have the First Amendment. And what we find with CRT and the diversity, equity, and inclusion training is that they are forcing people under threat of losing their jobs to engage in behaviors. And whether it's, you know, LGBT Day, where everyone's supposed to wear a rainbow or a purple shirt, and if you don't wear one, you're outed. And so you become part of a targeted person in a hostile work environment. All of these things are taking place. They are violations of laws and the Constitution, and the Department of Justice ought to be leading the battle to fight these things, but that is not happening.
Yeah. To the contrary, as you say, and it's terrifying, really, that we're seeing the Attorney General of the United States directing his Department of Justice and the FBI to begin treating, as you say, parents testifying before school boards in public sessions designed to invite and facilitate inputs from parents into how their children are being taught. These people are now being described as quote, potential domestic terrorists. And the state, you know, security apparatus is being sicked upon them. It's hard to imagine a bigger success for Marxists seeking the undoing of our country than that kind of, attack on not just freedom of speech, but on the very integrity of our public education system and how it, defines and pursues its pedagogy.
Well, Frank, people like us, we are considered intellectual domestic terrorists, and it's a label that I think we should wear proudly. You remember when the Southern Poverty Law Center, they would go after anyone and everyone. They've been quiet lately, but to have them.
They went after me with a vengeance, I can tell you.
Hey, and
I'm very familiar with it. And you too. Yes, ma'am.
I wore it as a badge of honor, and this going after us as domestic terrorists, that's meant to silence people, to get them to shut up and be intimidated. And we need Americans with courage. We don't need to, you know, quiver in our boots as we see our nation being taken away. And in many ways, when I look at the nation of my youth and the nation, even not just my youth, and the nation of 10 years ago, I don't necessarily see that same country. And I feel like in many ways that it's now or never. We need to take our stance. It's not going to get better. And there's, in his Glenn Lowry always says, there's no one going to, the cavalry's not coming. You know, we have to do it ourselves. There's no one going to save us. And so I think that people need to look at their own values and principles. And if they're not willing to stand for themselves, they need to stand for their children, for their descendants, because what's taking place now, it has far-reaching consequences. It looks as if communist China has more power and influence over our leaders than we do. And this whole thing about the vaccine mandates and people losing their jobs and being laid off, that is designed to wreck our economy. And I think people need to ask questions about why is the government so concerned about getting the vaccine into your system when the people that have gone out and followed the messaging and gotten the vaccines, they seem to be the first ones that are catching COVID. Even if they didn't have it before, they're catching it. They're spreading it to everyone else. And I know that COVID is not the topic that we're talking about today, but I can tell you that the politics around the vaccines and COVID-19 follows the Marxist agenda to the T.
Amen. And you know, one other point of connectivity, if I could suggest it, Carol, is the so-called vaccine passports. Because once you've got the mandates, and which I think you're absolutely right, is a control mechanism in its own right that is advancing in a very communist fashion, the centralization of power and control over population. You also get, you know, techniques for enforcing those mandates and that control. And that's where these, data repositories, not only for your health information, but inevitably for all kinds of information that the big tech giants have on us, you know, where we work, where we live, what we are saying, what we're buying, with whom we're talking, what, you know, kinds of transactions we engage in, and so on. That all can conduce very quickly in the wrong hands to something essentially identical to the so-called social credit system of communist China.
It's already in the wrong hands. And so you look at the Wuhan virus and the fact that China, we get our test kits from them, we get our masks from them, and our leaders are just, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, they seem more beholden to China and to other nations than they do to the American people. And so in some ways, it seems that we have already fallen. But I don't think it's too late. And when it comes to critical race theory, in this book, Black Eye for America, we have two chapters on strategies and how to fight back. We have a glossary because there's so many terms. If you say that you stand up as a parent and you question them on critical race theory, they will respond, no, I'm not doing critical race theory. We're doing culturally sensitive learning. We're doing educational equity. We're doing civil rights. But there are certain things you can look for to know if this is Marxism and critical race theory. The book has an index and it has resources, appendices with resources. And it is a tool for parents meant to equip Americans that want to understand what's taking place and how they can fight back against it.
Right. No, it is a tremendous teaching tool and as you say, resource. Let's quickly, in the remaining time we have, which is about 7 or 8 minutes, Carol Swain, just give us some of the highlights of the sorts of things that you think can be done to try to counter and take back our country from this Marxist critical race theory agenda.
In our last two chapters, we have one, strategies for resisting critical race theory's influence. And one of the first ones is surveying the battlefield. You have to look at what's taking place around our nation, and also to understand critical race theory enough that you can recognize when it's taking place. And you can do as these parents have been doing. They have been exercising their voice. They've been standing up to critical race theory, and that's very threatening to the progressive agenda. And that's one reason why the DOJ and other entities are trying to use intimidation to silence the parents. And then there's always exit.
At the behest, let me just add, at the behest of a George Soros-backed, you know, school board association that has called for the Department of Justice to treat these people, these parents, as domestic terrorists.
With the school board members, you know, they are a threat to them because a lot of the parents are running candidates against those school board members. They do plan to take them out, but take them out using legal means. And so the parents are not, they are organizing against these school board members, and they're reducing funds for CRT, and that's the biggest threat. That's why they feel threatened, because they've never had anyone looking over their shoulders.
They don't like it, because when you look over their shoulders, you see stuff that is antithetical to your values, to the traditions of our country, to our Constitution and civil rights laws, and so much more. And Carol, one other piece of this that that you emphasize is taking on big tech and its censorship. Talk a little bit about how that's playing into all of this, and what can we do about it?
Well, let me also say that you use voice, you use exit, you use guerrilla warfare, and guerrilla warfare
of the nonviolent
kind. That might make you a domestic terrorist, but we're talking about infiltrating their organizations, going to their meetings with a recorder on, catching them on tape, as well as using humor, creating memes, ridiculing them, using Saul Alinsky tactics against them. That's something we can do. And, you know, we have...
But peacefully, let me just emphasize, Carol, because I think this is really important to understand. And I admire so much your courage. And I think you are an exemplar of what needs to be done in our country to stand up for our country. And this is why you're book, this book and your others, and just, you know, your public presentations, your podcasts, Be the People podcasts are so vital. But I just don't want people to think for a moment that you are, in fact, a domestic terrorist in any true meaning of the word. You
hey,
are
I
not.
Don't mind
you are
being
a patriot.
An intellectual domestic terrorist. But I am
terrorist is terrorist the wrong word. You are a challenge to those who are trying to take away and, in fact, destroy our country. That does not make you the equivalent of a terrorist in any respect, as far as I'm concerned. And so I just want to say, I appreciate you so much because I think you are a patriot. You are a leader. And what you're talking about are using techniques that are all legal, all legitimate, and in fact, in some cases, come right out of the playbook of, you know, the radical left itself, but are nonviolent and are protected under our Constitution, are vitally needed at this moment. So just a concluding thought, if you would.
We have 10 proposals on how to fight back, and you have to understand critical race theory in its various forms, but challenge the legality and constitutionality of it, because it should fall just based on the laws. And if we had lived in a nation where there was a rule of law, that would happen. And, you know, continue to organize. Don't be intimidated by what's taking place. Use multiple strategies. And I would say that the concerns cut across political party, and that a lot of your neighbors who may be Democrats, they share your concerns. So build coalitions, educate your church leaders, pressure corporations in the same way that the political left does. But if they are supporting it, you know, stand up to them. And we do have to stand up to big tech, because they are engaged in viewpoint discrimination, and we have rights. And so continue to support the leaders, the few of them that are speaking up on our behalf, and monitor state and local governments, the governments that are using your money, your tax dollars, to support CRT and DEI. And I believe that we can prevail. We can defeat CRT and DEI. I think it's going to take a couple of years, and I don't think we should back down. And again, for myself, like, you know, Frank, I'm a senior citizen, Black woman, Christian church lady. And if they want to call me a domestic terrorist, I say, you know, if this is what terrifies you, you know, we all have things that terrify us. And so if someone that fits my profile, or some mother out there, you know, standing up to speak for her children, if that terrifies them, you know, they had the problem. But for myself, I will continue to speak out, and I would encourage other people to do the same thing. Don't let them use racial epithets or the name calling that they always engage in. And for white people, they're going to call you racist. They're going to call you nativist and xenophobe and all kinds of names. Don't allow that to silence you. And it's the biggest lie, you know, from the pit of hell, that only white people can be racist. Any racial and ethnic group can be racist. We all have an obligation to be anti-racist.
God bless you, my friend. Come back to us again soon with updates, Carol. In the meantime, stay well. I hope the rest of you will come back to us on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.